Star Walker Studios presents Game Master's Journey, your multidimensional RPG podcast. Hello, fellow gamer. Welcome to episode 259 of Game Master's Journey. I'm your host, Lex Starwalker. On this show, we discuss the craft and the art of game mastering. I've been running RPGs for over 28 years now, and I produce this show in the hopes that you can benefit from my experience, my triumphs, and my mistakes. I want to welcome everybody back to the show, to episode 259, and the first episode of season 14. Holy crap, I've been doing this for a while. But we're gonna start season 14 today. Hope everyone's been enjoying the summer. I know I've been enjoying my summer and a bit of a break from podcasting over the summer, although I have put out a few episodes here and there, kind of to wrap up season 13. But now everybody's getting back to school, and we're going to get back into it and kick off a new season of the show and have a lot of great things planned for this year for Game Master's Journey. So today we are returning to the Dungeon Master's Guide for 5th Edition D&D. And Brett is going to join me on the show again today, and he's going to help me start digging into Chapter 8 of the DMG, Running the Game. So I started this series over 2 years ago now, I think. It might even be getting close to 3 years now, when I started discussing the Player's Handbook. And when I first started this series way back when, I started it thinking of Chapter 8 and Chapter 9 of the Dungeon Master's Guide. This was really what I wanted to talk about 2 years ago when I first started doing these episodes. But as I could not find any podcasts anywhere that were discussing the core books of 5th edition in any detail at all, I thought it would be great for all of you, my listeners, to not just discuss Chapter 8 and 9, but to go through everything. So that's what we've been doing all this time. And now finally, I get to talk about the stuff that I've been really excited to talk about from the very beginning, which is how do we run the game? How do we take these rules in these books and actually use them at the table to create a fun experience for ourselves and our players? And also lots of possible variant rules and optional rules that we can use to tailor the game to exactly what we're looking for. And, you know, kind of a point there that I think sometimes gets overlooked is, you know, when you're looking at all of these options that you can use, you know, it's not just necessarily a thing of, you know, this is how I'm going to run all my D&D games. I'm going to use these rules and not use those rules. But you can actually use this on a campaign-to-campaign basis or even on an adventure-to-adventure basis. So you could change up the way you run the game and with the different rules that you use and how you use them for different adventures or different campaigns. Keep things fresh, keep things interesting, and really pull in the versions of the rules that are really going to help you tell the story that you're trying to tell and create the experience that you're trying to create. And that's one of the things I love about the DMG in this edition is that we're given so many options so you can kind of pick and choose a la carte what you want to use, what you don't want to use, and you can really dial in the experience that you're looking for. So I'm really excited to dig into Chapter 8 and then following that, Chapter 9. Now, because there is so much to talk about in these chapters, there's no way we're going to go through Chapter 8 in one episode. I don't want to produce a 4 hour long episode, and I'm sure you don't want to listen to a 4 hour long episode. So instead, we're going to do this in parts. This is probably going to be, I'm guessing, a 4 episode series just talking about Chapter 8. And then Chapter 9, I have no idea how many episodes that will take. It will really just depend on how many of these variant rules Brett and I really want to talk about in detail. But we're going to have a lot of fun and we're just going to take our time with this and it'll take as many episodes as it takes. So yeah, for the next few episodes, at least you can look forward to discussion of chapter 8, the various intricacies of the rules and how you can use them and even different ways you can use them or even not use them to get the experience that you're looking for. But before we crack open that DMG, I just want to let you know that that D&D supplement I've been talking about for so long, my collection of player character options that I've come up with for my games, which I've titled Adventurers of Primordia, is finally out. It is released. It is available. You can go check it out on my website over at starwalkerstudios.com. And it is just full of player character options that I've come up with for my game, for my campaigns and adventures that I've run. Things like spells, magic items, new cleric domains, new sub-races, all kinds of stuff like that. So check that out. I'm always hear from people wanting to know how they can help me out, how they can support Game Master's Journey and help me to continue to keep this show coming. And honestly, these days, I think the best way you can help me out is to purchase my D&D supplements. So I put out a few of them now, and you can check those out on my website. And also, for a limited time, I have a sale going on a bundle where you can get all of my D&D supplements I've put out so far, which is my adventure, The Trickster's Labyrinth, Relics of Power, which is how to make magic items that scale in power with the player characters, and finally, Adventures of Primordia. You can get all three of those together in a bundle and save 10% by doing so. And so, yeah, if you haven't gotten any of those, this is a great time to get all of them. You can help support the show, support what I'm doing, and get some stuff to use in your D&D games and save a little money all at the same time. So seems like a win-win. So yeah, please check that out on the website. And Adventures of Primordia has been out for a little while now. So huge thank you to everyone who's already purchased a copy. I really, really appreciate it. And I hope you enjoy it. And please, if you have feedback on Adventures Primordia, if there's things you love, things you didn't love so much, let me know. Shoot me an email, gamemastersjourney@gmail.com. I'd love to hear what you think of it. If you're using any of these options in your game, how it's going. A lot of these I'm using in my D&D campaign, Hinterlands of Alandria / Blood of the Avatars, which there's actual play for that in this podcast feed. A lot of those I've used in that and were developed for that campaign. So yeah, I'd love to hear what you all think of it. So I think that's it for the top of the show today. There are other things I'd love to talk to you about as far as, you know, what I've been doing lately. I've got listener feedback, new patrons to thank, new reviews, to share. But I'm going to save those for a future episode because we have a lot to cover today and I don't want this episode to be too long. So we're just going to get right into it and I'm going to bring Brett on board and we're going to start talking about DMG Chapter 8, Running the Game. I'm interested to see how this shakes out because I feel like having played in one of your games, I feel like we have pretty similar philosophies as GMs, but I think we definitely probably do some things differently. So
yeah. Yeah. There are little tweaks here and there that we each do, but
so yeah, it'll be interesting to see if there's some of these like rules that maybe, you know, one of us will have ideas of ways to use it that the other one wouldn't have thought of.
So, cool.
Yeah. So today we're talking about Chapter 8, which is Running the Game. Just lots of rules and how to use the rules. All right. So yeah, this is all like how to run the game. So the Player's Handbook has all the basic rules, I think, that you need. And this is more kind of getting into like specific cases you know, how to use different rules in different situations. And there's even a few optional or variant rules in here, which the next chapter, chapter 9, is all about the variant rules, which that'll be a lot of fun to talk about. So it starts out with table rules, which is not so much the rules of whatever game you're playing, but just kind of like your social contract or, you know, no smoking in my house, you know, stuff like that.
Right. Which are just as important as learning everything else.
Yeah. I think the third one here, have snacks. That's really important.
That's the biggest.
Yeah. I'm glad they pointed that out.
Forget the respect. Forget the distractions. Yeah. It's all about the snacks. What are you physically bringing to the table?
Yeah, if you're giving me cookies, I will tolerate some disrespect, but if there are no snacks, forget it.
You know, we make light of this, but it is a really good point, because there are cases, or there are environments that just don't work well.
Yes.
You know, and so it is good to remember this stuff. It's like a nice little reminder.
Yeah, and kind of, I think an aspect of this is, well, one aspect is who's running the game, who's the GM or the DM, and also who's hosting the game, as in whose house are you playing in? A lot of times it's the same person, but it's not always. And I'm curious what you think about this, Brett. As a GM, I want, if at all possible, I want to run either at my house or a public location. I do not enjoy running at one of the players' houses. Because I'm a control freak and I feel weird telling people what to do in their own house.
Okay.
I feel like I lose some of my GM authority when I'm in one of the players' houses.
I can see that. I don't know. I do have a little bit different opinion. I think once I'm in the game, the game is the game. And as long as I'm not demanding players go get me snacks, then I can DM or play anywhere. You have a little bit more control of your surroundings when you're at home, or actually mostly at home. I don't know about a public space. I feel like in a public space, I would be a little bit more quiet, not as, you know, I wouldn't have voices and loud bangs and I wouldn't get rambunctious.
Yeah, for sure. Well, and it depends on the space too, because it's one thing if you're playing in a library versus
I was just going to say
game store or
right
your high school cafeteria. Yeah, game stores can be fun.
I went to just on this topic really quick. I took the kids to the Renaissance Fair last weekend. And they had, thankfully, because it started raining and they all pulled us into the tent, but they had a big tent for D&D gaming. So while it was raining, the kids and I just kind of hung out and watched the different DMs play. It was really cool.
That's awesome.
It's like in a short area. It was probably like a con, I'm sure. I haven't been to one. But yeah, there were just like four or five different tables, each of them with their own DMs, and they were just loud enough to where if you move a little bit, you can hear one over the other.
Yeah.
And you can hear the different ways that they play. It was really interesting.
Yeah, that's cool. You can learn a lot watching other DMs.
You really can. Yeah.
How they do things differently. Like I know one of the things that really impressed me watching other DMs is the ones that never sit down. they seem to be a bit more energetic when they're standing up, moving around the table, and
the pacing DMs.
Yeah. Yes. So yeah, I don't know how much we really need to go into this, but the first thing is foster respect and dealing with disagreements and things like that. And I think here a big thing that helps me is anytime you get into a conflict at the table is, first of all, figure out, is this a conflict between the players or between their characters? Because sometimes you'll have character conflicts and the players will get into it, but everybody understands we're just role-playing. Nobody's personally getting their feelings hurt, and those can be a lot of fun, as opposed to when it's the actual players who are getting into it. And yeah, that's not fun for anybody.
Right. No, definitely not. Yeah, I have nothing to say on that. I think you're right.
Yeah. And just, I guess, also knowing that not all players are comfortable with the in-character conflict. So even if it's in character, you might have a given player that doesn't like that, especially if they're part of the conflict, if their character is part of it. So I guess just being aware of that and be, I guess, telling people to cool it when when you have to.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's ideally everybody would be open enough and comfortable enough with the rest of the players. But, you know, there are cases when you have a new player come in, or you're playing with people that you've never played with before, or who come from different sides of your friend spectrum, right? You've got work friends and family friends and all that. And if you get people together that you personally know, but they don't know each other, they might not be as comfortable. They might not be comfortable enough to say, you know, that's not really comfortable for me. I don't want to.
Yeah.
I'm not going to RP that.
Yeah. Yeah. And one thing, I think I had Shane from the Total Party Kill, Total Party Thrill. I can't remember the name of the podcast.
Total Party
Thrill, right?
Oh, crap.
I can picture their emblem. It's a red D20 with a blue hat.
Yeah.
Anyway, I had him on way, way back talking about social contract. And I think he was the one that brought up this idea of, I can't even remember what he called it. But basically, when you're playing with people that you don't know real well, having people kind of define any kind of a line they don't want you to cross, whether that's, I think he called it like lines and veils or something like that. But it could be something like, I don't want to deal with child endangerment, or I don't want to deal with incest or rape or really graphic depictions of violence or whatever. And, you know, if you're playing with friends of yours, you probably don't have to worry about this. But if you're playing with people you don't know real well, sometimes establishing that can be helpful.
Right.
Or maybe people don't want really graphic sex scenes, you know. Mm-hmm. So when one of those things is going to happen, you just kind of, you know, the camera fades to black kind of thing.
You know? Right. You allude to it. And yeah.
Right. Yeah. You don't have to like dwell on it and make everybody uncomfortable. So. So that's something you can do. Let's see. I feel like there's something else. Oh, yeah. So they were talking about avoiding distractions. And there's an example here that I've dealt with before. And that's the whole young children.
I don't know what you're talking about.
If I had a dollar for every time I had a player who wanted to host a game tell me, oh, my kid, it's so well behaved. You'll never know they're there. And yeah, never. They're never as invisible as the parents tell you they're going to be.
They can't be. That's just the nature of them.
But I mean, you can't really make rules, I guess. But I would say if there is a rule, there should be someone who's not playing the game there to watch the kid.
Oh, absolutely.
Not the person trying to play the game, because that will not work. It's not fair to the other players, and I don't think it's fair to the kid either, because.
Right.
You know.
Right. I can think of a couple of people that I used to play with that had that issue.
Me too. So, yeah, I mean, I guess if you're a parent, find someone to look after your kid. Don't think that you can look after your kid and like play a game at the same time.
Right. With the caveat, of course, that if you're in a casual game, you've got, you know, good friends over or family over or something like that, and it's just something lighthearted or whatever, then just make it aware.
Yeah. Or
for the sake of the game, make everybody known and aware that that's what's happening.
Yeah. If everybody's cool with it, then it's all good. Or if you're in a situation where maybe the kid can play, you know, if they're old
enough. Case in point.
Yeah. And they can play and the other players are down with that. Like that can be a fantastic solution to that problem. Cause then everybody's happy.
Yeah. Yeah. I ran one episode where my daughter played with us.
Yeah, that went really well. And in fairness, I mean, your daughter is not a kid.
She was
16, 17 when she played with us? 18?
It had to be 16 or 17, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, she's being 18 now.
Yeah, so that's a lot different than like a 5-year-old.
Really yeah, yeah.
Or even a 10-year-old.
Or a 13-year-old.
Yeah, yeah. So I don't know. I can't think of anything else really to say about table rules.
No, just be aware of everybody. Be respectful.
Yeah.
Have snacks. That's the best.
Don't be a dick.
Don't be a dick.
Table talk. Make it clear who's speaking, the character or the player. Yeah, that can be useful.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah, we've had a couple problems with that where we thought the character was talking and it was actually the player and vice versa. And nothing bad about it. It's just, it gets confusing.
Yeah. And this is a point where if you can do like a voice or an accent, that can be a huge help because we can hear the difference between the character and the player because you're going to talk differently, but not everyone can do that or wants to do that.
Or feels comfortable doing it.
Yeah. So I've seen other ways people deal with it. Like you wear a certain hat when you're in character.
Oh.
And take it off when you're out of character or vice versa. But
that's interesting.
Yeah. I mean, that's something, I guess if it's a problem for your table, you can come up with some way that people can indicate. I think where the problem comes in is when you start mixing up what the character knows versus what the player knows. And
right. Yeah. It does help a little bit. Some people also, it will, and go back and forth between the two, not just as a norm, but speaking in first person or third person. If you're speaking in third person as a character and then first person for the player, people do that a lot too.
Yes. Yeah, that works too. Another thing they mention here is, are you okay with players retracting what they just said their characters did or even said? And this, I think, is something about partly like the tone of your game. Because like, for instance, D&D, I've run some just ridiculous D&D games where people are just making jokes. And it wouldn't be unusual for someone to jokingly say, oh, I tell the noble this. And they don't really mean it. Their character didn't really say it. They're just making a joke and it's right. Fine. And then I've had other campaigns where it's more serious and it's like, no, if you say your character said something, they said it. You can't like go back and take it back because now I'm having the NPC react in a negative way. And you're like, oh, no, I didn't say that. So I think for that, just setting, like deciding for the given campaign where you want to go on that and then just being consistent.
Yeah.
And making sure the players know what you expect. Because if you're going to hold them to everything they say, then you should always do that. And definitely be fair among the players.
Definitely, yeah.
don't like let one player get away with stuff and then don't let the other players get away with it.
Let the funny one ramble.
Yeah. Yeah. No favoritism. Well, when he did it, it was funny. So it was okay. When you did it, it was just lame.
That just hurt. That was hurtful.
Let's see what else we got. Dice rolling. Yeah. So one thing here is, are you going to roll in front of the screen or behind the screen? Are you always going to do it one way or the other? So I guess if you're rolling in front of the screen, the players know you're not quote cheating. You're not fudging any rolls.
Right.
So that can give some tension. Especially like in a combat, like if you roll a crit against a player, like that crit happens, you can't take it back because they saw you roll it.
Mm-hmm.
So I know a lot of GMs will do one, or like they don't necessarily do one all the time. So they might sometimes roll in front of the screen. Sometimes they roll behind the screen.
Right.
What
right.
do you think, Brett? How do you handle that?
I prefer that. I prefer mixing it up. Usually I like behind the screen just to help push the story forward.
Mm-hmm.
But then for really dire, for things that I think are either really dire or that the players think are really dire, I would roll in front of them.
Yeah. For like those really dramatic moments where,
yeah,
you know, you're not going to fudge the dice no matter what. You might as well roll where they can see it.
Exactly. Exactly. There's no reason to finesse the rolls.
And the nice thing about rolling in front of the screen is, especially, I would recommend if you think you're about to kill a player character, always roll in front of the screen.
Yeah.
Because then they see it and they know that, you know, you're not just being a dick. You're not just trying to kill the character that, you know, that's how the dice rolled. On the other hand, if you think you're about to kill the character and you don't want to, and you think you might fudge that roll, then definitely don't roll in front of the screen. Yeah, and I think actually Matt Colville did a video about this that I really enjoyed. And, you know, a really good point I remember him making, because he does both, is that you want to roll behind the screen enough so that the players aren't suspicious when you do so. So you probably want to roll behind the screen more than you do in front of it, so that that way when you do roll behind the screen, they're not instantly thinking, oh, you know, Brett just rolled behind the screen because he's going to fudge something.
Right, right.
But if you do that most of the time, then they're not going to be thinking that. But if every once in a blue moon you just roll behind the screen, that's probably what they're going to think is like, oh,
yeah,
Brett wants to monkey with the dice. So
he's not really paying attention. It also doesn't help if you don't sell it. So if you roll the dice behind the screen and then you look off into the distance to come up with a number on your own, that's not very good.
Or you roll and you give them the result before the dice stop rolling.
Yeah, you still hear the clink, 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 clink. Yeah.
And another thing I've seen GMs do a lot is if they do roll behind the screen, but they want the character to see it, they'll just lift the screen up and so you can see the die laying there.
Oh, yeah.
And that's something you can actually, if you're a little good with sleight of hand, you could still fudge that roll without them knowing, but make it look like, hey, look, there's a die. You see it. That's
true.
That's a 20 right there. let's see. Another interesting thing here is times when you might maybe want to roll for the players. And also I would add to this, like using passive scores. So,
yeah.
For instance, I think the example they give is if a character is making an insight check to tell if an NPC is lying, that's an instance where you might want to roll for them because you don't want the player to necessarily know what they rolled.
True. I can see that. I've never done that though.
Well, I think the idea is let's say, you know, I'm running an NPC and you want to make a, what the hell is it called? Insight check to know if the NPC is lying. And then you roll a 5 and I say, oh no, the NPC is telling you the truth. You know, you might metagame and think, oh, well, I only rolled a 5. So they could still be lying.
Right.
And that might affect how you role play with that NPC, where if you didn't know you rolled a 5 and I just told you, oh, well, as far as you can tell, they're telling the truth. You'd probably just go with that. So I think that's the idea behind it.
What about having the player roll a d20 and not tell them what it's for? I guess you wouldn't know the you'd have to have all their bonuses down too. But
yeah.
I like the players having their, like, they're the ones rolling the dice, so it's kind of their power or their luck that's doing it.
Right. Yeah. I think the nice thing we have in fifth edition now is the passive scores. So a lot of the times I think of in the past where I might have rolled for a player, you can use the passive scores instead. So for instance, like perception, you know, a lot of times in previous editions where I might have a player make a perception check, now I can just look at their passive perception and see if they notice it or not. And I don't have to give anything away by having them roll a perception check. So yeah, they said you might roll behind a screen to preserve mystery. For example, if a player thinks there might be someone invisible nearby and wants to make perception check, you could roll behind the screen, even if no one else is there. So they think there might be things like that. You can kind of control player perceptions a little bit and pull some smoke and mirrors sometimes, which is a lot of fun.
Just make them roll at random.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, I think I was saying that, you know, the passive scores kind of help with that. So yeah, like perception, like if you have, maybe you have some goblins waiting to ambush the PCs, you know, if you ask them, hey, make a perception check, whether they succeed or fail, they know there's something there because you're asking for the check. Where if you know their passive perception, you can just check that against the goblin's stealth roll and the players don't know what's going on.
Right.
Until
right.
the goblins jump them.
Well, that's kind of the rule for passive, right?
The passive
rolls are supposed to take the place of either rolling for the players or having them roll at random.
Yeah, yeah.
Which makes so much sense. They have a default. If they're not focusing on something, they're not activating a skill, or they're not They're not rolling specifically. They're not calling out that they're paying attention to anything. So it'd be their passive.
Yeah. I think passive insight is a great thing. I use that a lot for social stuff.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because, yeah, if you're like, hey, Brett, why don't you roll... I keep wanting to call it intuition. Why don't you roll insight to see if you think this guy is lying? Like, I just gave it away, right?
Yeah, totally. Yeah.
So, yeah, it's nice to just be like, oh, I know, you know, Brett's character's passive insight is 13. So there we go.
So when you're DMing, do you think about that when you're talking about something specific? Say you know an NPC is lying. Do you automatically run through the calculation of passives, or do you wait for one of the players to say, I'd like to roll for?
Yeah.
I just wanted to say intimidation or
insight. I know it's hard to remember. I don't know why.
Man.
It kind of depends. Like, I think a lot of times I would wait for the player to do something. But I think if I had if I knew one of the player characters had a really high insight, then I might be like, oh, well, this character would just automatically notice because this guy isn't a very good liar. So I think if I knew their passive insight was like 5 or more higher than what the guy rolled, then I would probably just tell him, just be like, yeah you feel like this guy's shady. And I do that a lot with perception. Like, I usually have a list of all the characters and their passive perception, and I'll use that in deciding when I describe something, you know, deciding what different characters notice.
Oh, yeah.
And also, I mean, this is a tangent, but you can also think about their background sometimes. I know, like, really good, like, novels will do this. So, like, if Brett's character is a blacksmith, then he'll tend to notice things that are blacksmith related. So he might notice that this horse isn't shoed properly or something like that, where another character might not.
That makes sense.
So, yeah, if you really want to go all out. Rules discussions at the table.
Oof.
So that's something that, you know, will change group to group, but it's a good thing to think about, maybe talking with your players about, like, what do you want as far as that? You know, I think for a lot of us, we will have a point as GMs where we'll be like, okay, we've been talking about this too long. Let's put a pin in this. Let's go on. And then later, maybe we'll figure this rule out or whatever it is.
Right.
I mean, I guess some GMs will just be like, no rules discussions, period. but I feel like most of us, we kind of will allow it to some degree, but we have a point where we're like, okay, this is taking too long. And so I guess in that situation, like, I would just make a ruling on the fly and then say, hey, and I think I've done this with you guys, been like, hey, this is how we'll do it for now, but we'll figure this out between sessions and maybe change how we do it in the future. But for right now, we'll do it like this.
Yeah, that's tricky because I think every game I've played, many or most of the players have been DMs themselves.
Yeah.
And so, of course, everybody has their own ways to DM and remember different rules or, you know, different sets of rules that you would not remember offhand. So, yeah, it can get really tricky I can't think of any solid way to fix it, just to be prepared for it.
Yeah. And some, you know, some people enjoy that.
True.
So in some groups, you know, you may be fine talking about the intricacies of attacking from hiding for half an hour, you know, and if everybody's having fun with that, then go for it. I know when I first started running 5e, I mean, that's kind of how it was. And I even told the players, I'm like, hey, we're all new to this, so I'm okay with having some discussion of the rules just because we're all learning it. Myself included. Right. But the expectation was, as time went on, that we would do that less and less. I'm not sure.
There was. Well, if it never comes up again, then you're good.
Yeah.
There was a rule in Shadowrun that our friend Terry and I got into over. It was I cannot remember the name of, I can't remember which rule it was, but we went back and forth on it for years trying to figure out this rule. And it became a joke after a while because we couldn't, it every time we read it, we read something different.
That sounds like a very badly written rule.
I think it was just the way we were trying to interpret it. And yeah, so we'll see.
That's
funny. Well, we won't see. I haven't played Shadowrun forever. But.
I've heard of discussions like that with Shadowrun. I don't think that's a super uncommon thing with that game.
Yeah. Yeah. It's very rules heavy.
All right. I think the next thing, at least in my notes, is metagaming. So how much you are or are not okay with that happening.
Yeah, that's another tricky one because,
yeah.
Okay, so let's first define, well, not to turn this into a philosophy discussion, but so metagaming itself is like trying to outthink or trying to basically outthink the game, trying to take external influences and put them into the game, right? Like trying to think or figure out how many HP your opponent has or... knowing ahead of time what the scope of the game is and putting that knowledge into your PC as they're right. trying to make their decisions.
Yeah, I think kind of the example they give it, or sort of like this is like if you're running for your players and they encounter like say an adult red dragon and the players are like, oh, well, you know, this is a CR 15 or whatever it is creature. There's no way Lex would throw this at us now. So obviously we're not meant to fight it. You know, like,
right.
Like none of that reasoning has anything to do with the character or what they would think or how they would approach it. It's all the player approaching it as a game and thinking beyond the scope of the game to like, what would the DM do? Or you'll see this, I think sometimes with dungeons where certain rooms are just empty and the players figure that out. And they're like, oh, all these rooms are empty. So and it's like, well, their characters don't know that. The players figured it out because they know it's a dungeon and how dungeons are designed and blah, 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 blah.
Right.
They all have the same number on them. All the room 13s are empty. We figured that out. So, yeah, I mean, I think all GMs are going to get annoyed with this if it goes too far. I think for me personally... I'm actually okay with some metagaming, like especially in combat. And kind of the way I think about it is, first of all, your characters tend to be extremely capable people and specifically in ways that the players aren't themselves necessarily capable. So if I'm playing like a fighter, like a battle master fighter, my character knows way more about combat and tactics than I do.
Right.
And the other thing is the characters are presumably having hours upon hours of conversations while traveling, conversations while in camp, where they're maybe discussing tactics or, hey, what if, you know, what if I use my shield and do this and then you use that spell and do that.
Right.
And we're not going to sit and role play a lot of that, but you got to think that kind of thing happens.
Yeah.
So to some degree, I'm okay with some metagaming because I feel like it kind of covers that. It's like, well, you guys aren't going to sit down and role play coming up with tactics. So instead, you know, I'll give you a little wiggle room during an actual combat to kind of coordinate better, even though, you know, well, it's only a 6-second round. You couldn't really communicate all that. It's like, well, maybe you guys had a really long discussion about this in camp last week about what you would do in this kind of situation or something.
Or series, yeah. A series of talks around the campfire after the fact or after, you know, after previous encounters or whatever. I don't mind that kind of metagaming at all. I've been fortunate enough not to play with too many people who play it like a board game.
Yeah.
And take just the mechanics and try to work the system that way. I feel like that just that's on them. If that's the way they're going to get their fun out of it, then and it doesn't hurt the rest of the players, then I'm fine with it most of the time.
Yeah. And, you know, thinking about it, I think, you know, see what you, if you agree with this, Brett, but I think for me, metagaming in and of itself doesn't actually bother me. What bothers me is cheating. And yeah. a lot of times metagaming turns into cheating. And if I feel like the players are cheating, especially in a combat, that bothers me, and that I will stop.
Yeah, that makes sense. I agree with that.
And there's been some instances, like in our campaign that I've been running for you guys, where like I'm thinking of specifically one of the dungeons we were in where we were actually on roll 20 with a map. Where there were some times where some things were being communicated, and I'm like, you know what? Your character isn't even in the same room. There's no way you would see that or be able to talk to each other about that. So there were a few times that I kind of came in because I felt like, and I mean, I don't think anybody was consciously trying to cheat, but I felt like it was getting into like, okay, you guys are sharing information that is beyond what I think makes sense, and I feel like you're kind of cheating even if you're not meaning to.
Right
So that's where that makes I was sense. Like, okay, that's enough of that.
Yeah, and digital environments like that, like Roll 20, they're really easy to do, really easy to like move ahead in spaces if it's not set up, and learn more about the environment than your character would know.
But you can get into really egregious metagaming right up into, like, if you're running a published campaign, the player who's read the published campaign and knows what's coming and knows where all the secret doors are. And
yeah, I just don't play with them.
Yeah, no, me neither. I just had someone comment on one of my games on YouTube from way back when, saying they thought one of the players like knew too much about the adventure or whatever.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And I don't even remember what it was now, but I definitely didn't catch wind of that myself, because that's something I'm always on the lookout for, especially with a published adventure, is do any of the players seem to have more knowledge than they should?
Right.
Because, yeah, that can really be a problem, because you could be building up to like a really climactic moment and that player just ruins it for the whole table because they spoil it or whatever.
Right. That's just it. It ruins the fun of the game. It's like any kind of spoiler.
So personally, when I run published adventures, I'm always very clear about saying, hey, I only want people who have not played this, haven't run it, haven't read it. And then, you know, later on, if I feel like someone has read it, then it's kind of like they're very obviously going against the contract, because I was very clear in the beginning that I didn't want people who'd read it before. So that I don't have to feel bad about booting them. But I've never had that happen. I have had once or twice running some of these published 5e campaigns where I wondered about a certain player, like, man, do they maybe know more than they should? But I've never had an instance where I was pretty sure that that was happening. It never got to the point that I felt like I needed to do something about it.
Right.
But yeah, that can be a problem. Any other thoughts on metagaming, Brett?
No.
Don't do it.
Don't do it. Do it in moderation.
Yes.
Yeah, I don't think humans are wired to not metagame.
No.
I said that backwards, but yeah, I think we just do.
And whoa, yeah. So
it's a matter of discovering or of understanding the circumstances, knowing yourself well enough, and enjoying the game. I do know people who like to ruin things for other people, but like I said, I don't like playing with them.
Yeah, for sure. If you find one of those people in your group, get rid of them. I actually don't have this in my notes, but they have a little thing here about missing players. Specifically, what do you do with their characters? So some possibilities they give are having another player run the missing player's character, running the character yourself as the GM, deciding the character just isn't there for some reason, or having the character just kind of fade into the background. They're there, but they don't really do or say anything. So which of those do you tend to use, Brett? Or
how do you handle it? Yeah, I usually use the latter unless there's a way for me to, in the story, logically show them leaving or stepping away for a bit.
Yeah.
And if it looks like there's a way that they're going to be able to catch up with the players later, then I would do that.
Yeah. Yeah. It sounds like what I do. Have you ever had another player run the person's character? I've never done that.
No, no.
Seems like a bad idea.
or have I? Actually, I think I have. But it's more for, yeah, it's more for the combat. It's more for the technical end of the game. When you need everybody in the group for it and one person's not there,
yeah,
then that has, yeah, we have played games like that before.
Yeah. And running the character myself is usually something I try to avoid.
Yeah. DMs playing PCs I learned the hard way. That's not the way to go.
Well, and we already have so much other stuff to do. Last thing we need is to play a PC on top of it.
Right, right. Well, okay, so when I was much, much younger, there for a while, it was just two of us trying to play. And so because there were two of us and because I wanted to play too, I figured, well, I would make a PC and then I would DM the whole thing.
Sure, yeah.
This wasn't for D&D, this was for another game. But yeah, and that was just too, that was too much.
That was my MO for my first probably at least 2 or 3 years as a GM. I always had a DM PC in the party.
Yeah.
That was just how I did it. The first thing I would do after I came up with what's this campaign about was, well, what's my character going to be? I think I was doing that for some of the right reasons, but also some of the wrong reasons. But I don't do that anymore. Yeah, so then we go into small groups, and I now realize I don't have something I was going to bring into this, so I might have to go run and grab something.
Okay.
But they're talking about, like what if you have a smaller number of players, different ways to approach that. You know, one way would be having players play multiple characters.
Yeah, I've played that way.
Yeah. So what do you think about that solution, Brett?
Again, it's good if you're playing a game for the sake of the game. It works.
Yeah.
But if you're trying to get into a story or into more dynamic role playing, I don't want to say it's impossible. It's practically impossible.
Yeah.
Unless you're playing with people with multiple personality, it might work, but trying to keep different NPCs in your head straight is tough enough. But yeah, if you have everybody at the table doing it, then it gets confusing fast.
And what I've noticed when players do play multiple characters is they will tend to have kind of their quote main character. That's the character that they really role play. And the other character is just kind of there and they'll need them. They'll use them when they need them for a skill check or in combat.
Exactly.
But they kind of forget about them. It's kind of like the wizard's familiar that like just is in the gray mist the whole time because no one remembers the poor wizard's familiar. The wizard forgets them. The DM forgets them.
yep. Until it's time to make a check. Yeah. Or enter combat.
Yeah. And I feel like that's one of the downsides really of D&D as it's kind of constructed as a game is this idea, whether it's really true or not, we have this idea that we need a certain number of players and we need a certain number of roles filled or we need certain classes.
Mm.
And if you don't have that, what do you do?
Right.
Like we don't have a healer. What do we do?
Well, the good thing with homebrewing is that you can come up with stories that, and this is my preference. You can come up with stories that would only need one or two people. You can do things that that are a much smaller scale to where and you can gear a specific campaign or a specific story toward that one or two characters that you're running through so that it's specific to them so that you don't need a cleric. You could just have a thief or you can have a cleric and no thief. You don't need to be stealthy or anything like that.
Yeah, totally.
That could actually be kind of fun. I ran a Terry ran a story through when we first started Tarindol. Andy couldn't make it that week, so he just ran a one shot with my character. So he DM'd and I ran a rogue through the city.
Cool.
Yeah, it was a lot of fun.
I think you could run a whole campaign with everybody playing rogues. That'd be a lot of fun.
You probably could. That would be awesome.
Yeah. Let's see. So some of the ideas they give here is you can use for specifically, say you don't have a healer, you can use the healing surge variant rule, which we'll talk about in the next chapter. but that makes healing during combat for everybody easier. You know, my way that I try to address this lately is just with magic items. You know, so let's go with the healer. That seems to be the one that's most common. You know, if you don't have a healer, it's like, well, what do you really need from a healer? You need someone, I guess, to heal damage in combat. But I feel like really what you need a healer for is for like getting rid of conditions. Like if someone gets cursed or poisoned or paralyzed or turned to stone or something like that.
Right.
And later in the game, you maybe need a healer for like resurrection type stuff.
So then
the actual healing. So those things you can cover with magic items. So you can just hand out magic items at the beginning of the game that make up for that. So give some extra healing potions, or maybe give them a wand or a staff or something that lets them cast remove curse and lesser restoration, greater restoration.
I was just going to say,
like another example, if you're missing a rogue, I'm blanking on the names of the items, but there's a wand that unlocks, or like the chime of opening.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
Doors. There's a wand of detection that will detect traps and secret doors. And so I feel like there's a magic item that'll do about anything that a class could do. And if not, you could create one to kind of fill those gaps.
Right.
Another possibility, and this is getting into the kind of Monty Hall territory, and I think this might be in chapter 9 too, is you could use gestalt characters, which is where it's basically like combining two classes into one. You could make it like a gestalt fighter cleric who is basically like a fighter cleric multi-class character, but they only have one. You just give them both things at once. So when they're a second level character, they have all the abilities of a second level cleric and a second level fighter. They get better of the two hit dice, the better of the saves and all that. So, you know, that only works if all the players are doing it.
Right.
But especially if you have a really small group, that can work.
As a player, that would be really fun.
Yeah. Yeah, I think it'd be fun. Everybody's like basically two classes in one.
Right.
And you just say, you know, everybody's got to have cleric, or someone's got to have cleric somewhere, and someone's got to have rogue somewhere. Other than that, do whatever you guys want.
Right.
That will get pretty, I mean, it'd be pretty overpowered compared to other campaigns. So.
Yeah. It would be good for a campaign of one or two players.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah. They also mention, of course, they bring up NPC followers.
Yes.
As an option too. They say to fill out the party, but what about leaving NPCs at camp? If you're, well, I guess it depends on the story, but or at a waypoint where they can retreat, where players can retreat to get healed and whatever they need from the NPCs.
Oh yeah, totally. So like if you're missing a healer, you could have an NPC healer of some kind that doesn't necessarily go in combat with you, but is nearby.
Right. Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Well, I think at this point I will go grab the thing.
Okay.
Because the new essentials kit, which I'm going to talk about on another episode.
Oh yeah.
Has the idea of sidekick characters. Which are segue. NPCs. Okay. That go with you, and that
squires.
Was yeah, and that was kind of their solution in that for if you have a small group. And I didn't actually look at how they approach that, so let me go get that and we'll see if that is any good or not.
Cool. All right,
I'll be right back.
Okay.
All right, I got it. Let's see what this says. Oh, okay. So they're just NPCs.
Oh.
I thought there would be more to it than this. So they have three sidekicks here. So this is in the Essentials kit, which is the new beginner box for D&D. And I'm going to do a review of it. I really dig it. It's even better than the, what was the other one called? The starter set.
Right.
It's like the starter set, but better. So they have three NPCs for your sidekicks. They have the spellcaster, expert, and warrior. So the idea here is if you have a small group, your character can have an NPC sidekick and they get XP. And then, oh, and then they have advancement tables for them.
Oh, I was going to say, so they level with the characters?
Yeah. Yeah. So I'm pretty sure the way this works is you just count the sidekick as another PC. So every time you give out XP, you just divide it that many times. Everybody gets equal XP. Mm. And then, yeah, they have kind of, for instance, the spellcaster, they have stats for second through sixth level, kind of what they get. But basically, they get more hit dice and they get kind of abilities similar to what a PC would get. So the spellcaster is getting higher level spell slots. The expert is getting like cunning action and expertise. And so, yeah, I mean, I'm pretty sure the expert, the warrior, and the spellcaster, those are probably all in either the player's handbook or the monster manual. They're pretty standard NPCs, I think.
Yeah.
But I think there's the acolyte, which is kind of a cleric like NPC that has like cure light wounds and stuff like that.
Oh, right.
So in the DMG, I think, or is it the monster manual? One of them has rules for if you want to take an NPC and give them more hit die or whatever, how that works. So you could easily take like the acolyte and have them go with the party as an NPC. And then as the PC's level, you could advance that NPC
cool.
too. So that could work. But again, these are NPCs. They're not player characters. So you're not rolling right. up a cleric.
Right.
Because
they're there to answer questions.
Yeah. Yeah. And they're more simplified.
Right.
So you're not going to get bogged down with dealing with a full player character as a DM.
You know, a side benefit of, just an added benefit of having NPCs as the players travel, whether it's for a larger party or a smaller party, is it gives the DM a voice as the characters need to talk, or if they need to expound on something or just talk about different things, the NPC can be the voice of the DM as well. Just kind of adding to that so that they're able to talk to the players through the NPC.
Yeah.
And add information.
I totally agree. And I think it's too bad that there's such a problem with the whole DMPC thing. which just in a nutshell is the idea of the DM playing an actual player character as part of the party and kind of like wanting to be a player and a DM at the same time. And it leads to all kinds of problems. But I think the problem is with that is we have such an aversion to that maybe we don't want to have NPCs in the party, which is a different thing.
Yes.
And exactly what you're saying, Brett, like that's why I always want an NPC in the party, even if the NPC is a magic item, like a sentient item or a wizard's, whatchamacallit?
Familiar.
Or, you know, anything that could have a voice, whatever that is, like I want something like that in the party, exactly for what you said. So when they're in the middle of nowhere, I can still interact with them. And it doesn't even have to be about like telling them what to do next or just role playing, you know.
Exactly. It could be giving information they don't have. It could be giving them a venue to bounce ideas. Yeah, any number of things.
Giving them bad ideas. I love NPCs that are not necessarily as expert as the player characters, so they can give really bad suggestions. And sometimes the players will actually take the really bad suggestion.
It's like, well, DM said that's metagaming. That's how metagaming gets you in trouble.
Yeah, exactly.
It's like, well, the DM said that, so
the DM's role playing a really dumb NPC right now.
Yeah.
So yeah, so I guess we kind of hit the highlights of dealing with a small group. You can either write an adventure in such a way that it doesn't matter, or you can give them a sidekick or other kind of NPC to travel with them, or give them magic items to fill in the gaps, or have them play gestalt characters, or just give them abilities. Like, I did something kind of sort of with this, with the pre-gens for a Numenera campaign I was making. The idea of like, well, maybe you're going to run a dungeon and you really need a rogue, or more specifically, you need someone who can open locked things, and no one plays a rogue. Maybe just give the bard the skill. What is it? Disarm traps, or whatever. Disarm
traps, yeah.
Whatever skill rogues
detect use traps, disarm
to, yeah. Or sleight of hand, I think is what they use to open. Or no, they just use the toolkit. God, I haven't played D&D in a while. The thieves tools. So you could just give the bard or any character, just give them proficiency with thieves tools, and problem solved. Now you don't need a rogue.
Oops.
So yeah, there's ways to handle it.
Yeah. Yeah.
Now the thing that you can't fix, I feel like, is just having enough players for it to be fun. Like, true. I feel like you gotta have, I feel like three players is kind of the minimum I want. You can do it too.
Yeah, but you can do it with two. And yeah, I've played with two for so long that's kind of what I was used to for the longest time.
Yeah.
But yeah, once you get into the bigger games, it kind of trades the interaction with the amount of time each person gets. So each person gets a little less time, like in combat or what have you, because you have to spread the wealth. Everybody gets equal time or should get equal time. But there's more back and forth.
Yeah.
Not as much back and forth with, I was going to say with one person. Shouldn't be back and forth with one person. But yeah, then again, it depends on the person.
Yeah. Solo PC campaign is a very different.
Yeah.
It's very different. It can be fun. I'm not, you know, but it's different.
It's a different beast. You have to be prepared for
it. Yeah.
And it can absolutely be fun. It just depends on the story that you're running.
I would say, just as an aside, if you're running like kind of a longer term campaign for, you know, a decent sized group of players, and you've never tried it, try doing like our vignettes that we did where you just get together one-on-one with the players just for an hour or two.
It's right.
A lot of fun.
Yeah. Yeah. The players get a lot of benefit out of it. They get one-on-one time. They get to brainstorm ideas or talk about things about their character that they don't normally get to in the full party.
Yeah. And it works really great if you have a rogue, because rogues are notorious for wanting to do all these things that don't involve anybody else in the party. So those can be great to handle in like a one-on-one session where the rogue goes out and scouts and the next session, they have all this information to give to the other players.
Well, yeah, especially if you can set it so that at the end of that session, the last thing that's done before the DM calls it quits for the day is the rogue runs off.
Yeah.
And that's where we'll end.
That's right. That's right. So I guess using an example that probably most people are familiar with, I think this has been done quite a bit in the various Critical Role adventures. Maybe not with solo characters, but they will often do like a little vignette with just one or two characters where they kind of do their own thing, for usually because people can't be there or whatever. But
right.
Yeah. So that's something, you know, you can have fun with too. Let's see, new players, like bringing new players into the game, pretty straightforward.
Yeah.
I think they suggest here giving them a character equal in level to the lowest leveled PC.
Yeah, that's fair.
So if they're all the same level, I guess they'll be the same level.
Right. The drawback is that player coming in is not going to know his character very well, his or her character.
Yeah.
But that'll fix itself in time.
If the PCs are very high level, like beyond, I don't know, tier one, you might want to suggest a new player play something other than a wizard or a cleric. Have them pick a simpler character, maybe. But right, I guess that's up to them.
Also a good place for a vignette.
Yeah, for sure.
An intro vignette to bring the character on board. Just turn a level zero, a session zero session into the character build slash like a quick intro to where the character comes into the party is what I mean.
Yeah. And you know, I like what they say here, you know, just make them the same level of the lowest level player character. I used to worry about this a lot in the past because I feel like, I mean, we've talked about this a little bit with XP. Like, I feel like the players earn XP and, you know, you guys have been playing for weeks and weeks and weeks and you fought your way up to fifth level. And if I bring this new player in and they get a fifth level character right out the gate,
right.
I feel like it's not really fair. And I used to worry about that a lot and I'd start them like a level lower or whatever. But at the end of the day, I mean, I don't think the players care.
No. And you're hurting the players. In the long run, you're hurting all the players. So the party as a whole gets this new character into their dynamic who is way too low in character and level and can't do half the stuff that they should be able to do with this group. So they're hindering the party. Meanwhile, the new player is feeling like the odd man out because he can't do anything yet. And everybody has to protect him, her, so, or him.
Yeah. They're just a liability.
Exactly. So I think ultimately it's in the best interest of everybody. It's fair in that everybody has more fun in the end.
Yeah. And I just want to point out, let me see if I can find it. There's a little chart earlier in the book for additional like equipment or magic items you can give them. So it's on page 38. And it just gives ideas for additional equipment to give for beginning characters that are higher than first level. And
got
one for low magic campaigns, standard campaigns, and high magic campaigns. So even with this, like for instance, 11 to 16th level in a standard campaign, they'd get 5,000 gold plus 1d10 times 250 gold, two uncommon items, and then the normal standard equipment. So it's like, yeah, they get two magic items, but your characters that have been playing up till 11th level probably have a lot more than two uncommon items.
Right.
So I feel like they're still, even though they're the same level and they're getting some more stuff, they're still not going to be on par with those other characters. So it's not like they got everything that the other players got for actually playing. Right. They're still a little behind.
And not necessarily as personalized, right?
Right. Yeah.
And depending on how the characters came up with their current stuff.
Yeah, for sure. So yeah, I think that's a great way to do it. And don't worry about, and it also makes your life easier as a GM. If everybody's the same level.
Yes.
Makes everything easier. All right, well, that's going to wrap it up for episode 259 of Game Master's Journey. Huge thank you to Brett for joining me today. Really appreciate you taking your time to talk with me about the DMG. And I just think it really enhances these episodes. It's a lot better than just listening to me read the DMG and talk to myself. So thank you so much, Brett, for joining me today and making this a lot fun for me, and I'm sure for the listeners as well. As far as you listeners out there, if you would like to get a hold of me and share your thoughts and your GMing wisdom, gaming experiences, tell me about your favorite character, whatever you want to do, you can shoot me an email at gamemastersjourney@gmail.com. If you want to keep up on what I'm up to and what's going on with the show, you can follow me on Twitter at Lex Starwalker. You can also join our communities on MeWe and Discord. You can find links to those in the show notes at starwalkerstudios.com. And you can call my voicemail, 951-GMJ-LEX-1. That's 951-465-5391. And leave feedback, questions, comments. And who knows, you might even hear your voice on a future episode. If you enjoy the show and you'd like to help support what I'm doing, again, probably the best way you can do so is to purchase one of my D&D supplements. However, another great way to support the show is to become a patron. Patrons get some cool perks, not the least of which is their own private RSS feed, which includes all of the episodes for Game Master's Journey. The public feed just has 100 episodes just due to the limitations of my website hosting provider. So that's just the way it has to be, unfortunately. But the patron feed that the patrons get access to has all the episodes going all the way back to episode one. Also has all of the GM Intrusions episodes, which are 70 odd episodes of those, which was a precursor to this show, very similar to this show, more focused on Numenera, but lots of just great general GM stuff, just like on this show. So you're talking close to, I think, 400 episodes of content at this point. It's kind of insane, or 300, sorry. Still insane. Yeah. So there's a lot to keep you busy there if you can get on the patron feed. So thank you to all the patrons. If you're a new patron, I will be thanking you personally on a future episode when we have a little more time. So I hope that you have a chance to play your favorite RPG this week. I hope you have a chance to run your favorite RPG. And if you do, let me know. Tell me about it. I'd love to share your experiences with the other listener GMs. I will be back soon with another episode of Game Master's Journey. And until then, game on.
This has been a Starwalker Studios production, your source for quality gaming and hobby podcasts.
This episode's music, courtesy of Cloudwalker, Transboy, Renfield, Stanko, and Ish. See the show notes for more details at starwalkerstudios.com/gamemastersjourney.